True Crime Today.
This is the ongoing story of a small Idaho town and its residents, a tightly knit community that hasn't seen a murder since 2015, an environment where one thought they could feel safe and secure until a quadruple homicide stole the lives of four young souls on a mid-November evening, leaving far more questions than answers. Where will the investigation lead, and how do we get there? This is the University of Idaho Murders podcast. Four killed for what?
Welcome to the podcast. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts to not miss any breaking updates and discussion on this case as we have it for you. My name is Tony Bruschi. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod for more on this case and thoughts and discussions off the air. Today, we're going to continue talking with Bobby Chacon about the case. We're going to dive deeper into this, even discussing possible defense angles that may be used in the Brian Koberger case, as he's obviously being accused of first-degree murder, four counts of it on the victims in Moscow, Idaho. Before we get to that conversation, though, just last night on News Nation, Brian Enten hosted an hour-long special about the case, kind of bringing everyone up to date, maybe those who have just begun following it, giving a timeline and bringing everyone up to speed on where things are sitting right now. In that interview, he had a chance to talk with Olivia Gonsalves. She's, of course, the sister of Kaylee Gonsalves, one of the victims in this case. And there's so many things that have come out over the last week, especially with this probable cause affidavit being released. And with that, we've learned many things. One of those things that we learned is that one of the surviving roommates did see what they believe was Brian Koberger leaving the house after he committed those crimes. And with that being said, there's been a lot of very uncalled for criticism of that young person for how they acted from people, quite honestly, who've likely never, ever been in that sort of situation. But I have heard from many who have been in that situation and all of them saying it's not surprising when you are in that much fear for something like that to happen, or for you to pass out, or for you just to not know what the right thing is to do in fear for your own life and not understanding what actually had gone on. Olivia Gonsalves shed some light on that and speaks out about the criticism that has been going on online. Let's hear her audio from last night on News Nation with Brian Enten.
I don't have any other information for that. I do know Dylan is really young, and she was probably really, really scared. And until we have any more information, I think everyone should stop passing judgments, because you don't know what you would do in that situation.
Very, very true. Brian went on to ask about Koberger and the connection to the victims. How exactly is there a connection? And here's what Olivia Gonsalves had to say.
Yeah, I think we're still going to keep looking. I've had a lot of people reach out with, Instagram posts or even Spotify or lots of connections that they've been able to find. And those are super valuable. All of those go over to, you know, the Moscow Police Department, as well as the Idaho State Police and the FBI, because nothing is insignificant at this point. And everything is being looked through.
Olivia Gonsalves there talking with Brian Enten on News Nation on Sunday night. Now on to our conversation today with Bobby Chacon. Bobby, of course, retired FBI special agent, giving us a lot of insight onto this case from an FBI perspective. Bobby, welcome back. I wanted to ask your opinion on this. Now that we have the probable cause affidavit, now that we know much more about what went on with the alleged suspect, alleged murderer, Brian Koberger, as a defense, that's a big question, because to many of us, we look at this affidavit, we look at what's online, and just the facts that exist. And this does, I think, to many of us, feel like a very solid case. At least that's what many of us want to believe. But let's talk a little bit about that defense, which is going to be mounted at some point should he plead not guilty here on the 12th. Bobby, what kind of angles do you think the defense could begin taking once this does go to trial, if in fact it does go to trial, to defend Mr. Koberger?
Yeah, I hate to put my head. I'm an attorney as well, but I don't like to put myself in the space of a defense attorney. But I've been there many times on the witness stand where defense attorneys are ripping me apart. I mean, look, the first thing they're going to do is you don't really have anybody, any eyewitness putting him at the scene. Even the one eyewitness that's in the affidavit says he was wearing a ski mask. Yeah. So, you know, bushy eyebrows are not exactly the most reliable form of eyewitness identification.
Sure.
Right. So I think that, you know, they're going to attack that. They're going to try to come up with some theory on how his blood got on that sheath. That's very difficult to do. I'm not saying anything, any of these are going to be prevail. Not any of these are going to be, you know, believed, but a defense attorney has to come up with some defense. So number one, my client was never seen at the scene. That's number one. He was never there. He had that blood on the sheath. They'll come up with some explanation on, you know, why his blood is on that sheath. Now, as we talked earlier, if they have more DNA, you know, the bar goes higher for them. I think they have a high bar in this. You know, the fact that his cell phone was turned off just during the time the murders were committed almost hurts him.
Yeah.
I know what he was trying to do. Again, an amateurish attempt at hiding his movements, but he left it on his way there. And then as he gets into the area, it's off for the time of the murders, and then magically it turns back on right after the murder. So that blacked out period almost makes it look worse for him, right? So I think they're going to say he wasn't in the area. You have no proof that he was ever in that house. You know, the DNA was, you know, I mean, look, we've seen DNA attack before, you know, way back when, decades ago in the OJ trial, right? DNA was contaminated. It was cross-contaminated. You know, they always say when you can't attack the facts, attack the police. So that's a defense axiom, defense counsel axiom. So they could say it was collected wrong. There was cross-contamination. It's not really his DNA. Whatever else they come up with, they will have DNA experts paid for by the defense to come in and say why that is not a legitimate DNA sample of his or source of DNA of his. I don't know what that is or how they'll try to couch it. But first and foremost, I think they'll say he wasn't at the scene. He's not the bushy eyebrow guy. And then they'll work on having some expert come in and say why that DNA sample is not reliable.
Is that why they would likely have more DNA samples in their back pocket, assuming that would come through at some point of, yeah, you may say this, but what about this underneath fingernails or whatever else they may have?
I think so. But I mean, remember, Long before the trial, the government will have to produce all of its evidence in the discovery process,
sure,
and give it over to the defense. So
yep,
all of the DNA that they intend to use at trial and all the lab examinations of that DNA will go over to the defense with enough time for the defense to get its own experts to examine those reports and those samples. So so there will be no gotcha moment. They may have held back now a little bit because they just don't want it all out there.
Yep.
But eventually the defense will have access to all that with more than enough time for the defense to kind of get its own experts to review and analyze it itself.
In trials today, based on your experience, is eyewitness testimony an antiquated defense with so many other just definitive ways of identifying people, such as DNA, such as cell phone pings, things of that nature?
Well, yes and no. And here's why. Look, I read recently that 85% of the wrongful convictions in the state of California, where I am, were the result of faulty eyewitness identification. Now, some of that is intentional. Most of it is not. The person just thought they saw a different person, right? People look alike. You know, conditions are different, dark, whatever. So eyewitness identification is one of the least reliable sources of putting a person in a place. However, it's also something a jury really likes. And we as people like to relate to other people. So if I see a person on the witness stand and they tell me I saw that person that night, rather than I get some forensic person saying I took a footprint sample and here's how I put the paste in the footprint and I took a mold of the footprint and I compared it to this shoe and the shoe was like, you know what I mean? It's like, it, you know, it's long, it's boring, it's scientific. And it's a lot more drawn out than I can see somebody saying that's the guy I saw in the alley that night. So eyewitness identification is not reliable. Well, in most cases, it's not reliable. It can be attacked and things. But it's also something a jury really likes to hear.
Sure. is it not necessarily as reliable as the other sources, but it's simpler and it's easier to, I guess, digest for the general public who would be in a jury pool. Let's talk about his mindset for a moment. I mean, the students described his demeanor, the students that were in his class described a change after the date of the murders, from being very detailed and strict with grading to giving suddenly 100s on papers and acting as if he didn't really want to be there. Would you speculate that he was feeling remorse or regret or anxiety and fear that he may be caught, because he, I'm sure, realized that knife sheath is not in his possession anymore. It's at the scene, or something else entirely?
Well, I don't think it's remorse or regret. I think it's, I think what it is when I think this crime was built up over weeks, maybe months in his mind. Mm-hmm. So he's gearing himself up for this. He may have been following them. He may have been sitting in a coffee shop, across a coffee shop with them. He may have been standing in line at a grocery store behind them, whatever. He built himself up. This was a process in his mind that all culminated in that, you know, 8 or 10 frenetic minutes of a killing frenzy. The adrenaline was rushing through him. And there was a physical exertion along with that, you know, adrenaline. And I think that one of the reasons people survived in that house was he was simply too exhausted physically to actually continue. And so I think he didn't anticipate that. So all that adrenaline made him crash. And I think that changes in the short term, and maybe even in the long term, from people I've spoken to, your brain chemistry. You have your brain kind of gets scrambled, and there are different things that go through. And I think the behavior that is exhibited, the change in his behavior, was a result of that, was a result of there were tons of chemical processes going through his body, both leading up to, certainly during the killing, and then after the killing. And so, can you imagine a hangover? An alcohol hangover might last for a day if it's really bad, too. This kind of thing is a hangover that could last for weeks. Because it's mental and physical. There are a lot of mental processes going on and a lot of physical chemical processes going on in his body, mainly in his brain. And so I think that his change in behavior is based on those changes. Like it took him months to kind of build up to this, maybe weeks or months to build up to this. And now he's going over it. He's reliving it in his brain over and over and over again. And if he's watching the news coverage of this early on, he's reliving it over and over again. And that's causing him to kind of stay in the moment or to be like on this down side of it. And I think what those students are describing in him is his kind of hangover, you know, if you will. I mean, it's not the proper psychological term, but it's what I consider like a hangover from this event.
Based on your experience working with criminals, what do you think and speculate would be going on in his mind now that he's been caught and behind bars and is on track to be tried for murder?
You know, I think some of that relates to his relationship with his parents. I think now that maybe the parents knew before he was arrested, but certainly now that the parents know after, they hopefully had some heart-to-heart talks with him. And, his relationship with his parents, I think, will be key to his outlook on this, on his positioning, on whether he wants to fight this, whether he wants to plead guilty, whether he wants, you know what I mean? I think a lot of that depends on that. And I think, you know, he's going through his mind. Look, he's not stupid. I'm not saying when I said he was not a master criminal, an amateurish, I'm not saying he's stupid, but he's obviously got some level of intelligence. And so I think he's able to, at this point, weigh, and he's going to have counsel describe to him what the government has, what the evidence is, but he's probably in a waiting pattern. His counsel is probably telling him, let's wait and see what the government has, and then we can go and do an analysis of what are our chances of fighting this? What are they offering, if anything, as a deal, which they may not. And so, I think that all of that is playing in. I think he's going to wait on advice of counsel to see what the evidence against him is. He has a right to do that. He has a right to see that evidence. And I think that because he's analytical, and I think like a, you know, PhD, I always think of PhD academics as being very analytical because it's all data driven. It's data collection and data analysis. And so I think that he will, on advice of counsel and through his own, you know, background, I think analyze the evidence against him and make a decision on how he's going to approach this, you know, based on that.
Based on all of that, and then again, based on your experience, do you feel that this is someone where the narcissism level is so strong that he's going to continue to try and fight this? Or in the face of very, very damning evidence? Or at some point, is it just so much that he's going to say, you know, I'm going to plead guilty and, you know, for the if there is a deal with the death penalty maybe being taken off the table?
Yeah, that's the $64,000 question. I mean, I don't see him as the last serial killer I worked when I was with the FBI was Israel Keyes, and we got him after he admitted 11 homicides to us, separate and independent. I think he probably did close to 30, but I don't think this guy is like that. I don't think he's like this narcissistic serial killer, you know, who made a lifetime living of it. And as Keyes did, he was 34 when we arrested him. Mm-hmm. And he had killed, you know, since he was like 17 or something, or 19. But it's yet to be seen. I think in his first court appearance, we haven't seen him speak too much yet. I think as in the next couple of weeks and maybe month or two, as we see him in more hearings and stuff, we'll start to get a better feel on his level of narcissism. Again, his relationship with his parents, to see like if they prevail on him to take responsibility. You know, if in fact he did it, you know, okay, of course, presumption of innocence. Yeah. I don't know his level of narcissism. I don't think he's like the serial killer level of narcissism that Israel Keyes demonstrated. But yet to be seen. He may be. It's just we don't have enough history of him to know, you know, what level of narcissism he has, or whether he's going to be able to overcome that and take responsibility.
Something that ran through my mind, we were speaking earlier of incels, and whether or not he completely fits that profile or not, I believe he has some traits of that. Based on that, and just knowing the history of people like that have committed horrible crimes such as this, many of them killed themselves shortly thereafter or right immediately after or at the scene. Do you think Koberger is a suicide risk at this point?
Yeah, I do. I mean, and that's not to say that he has any kind of conscience or anything. Look, Israel Keyes killed himself before he went to trial because he lost control. He was a control freak and a narcissist, and he couldn't stand that he wasn't controlling the narrative anymore. Mm-hmm. So I don't say he's a suicide risk because he would feel remorseful. He could be a suicide risk because he's lost control. And you know, a narcissist and a sociopath, they like to be in control. And so, it's always, and I lost a lot of sleep when Israel Keyes killed himself, because that was my last serial killer case that I was working. And he hung himself in his prison cell. I say that it's better to err on the side of putting them on suicide watch. And we know he was wearing a suicide vest, which is not like a terrorist suicide vest, but it's a thing that the prison people used to make it harder for them, to carry out a suicide. And so I think that, he should be on suicide watch. He should remain on suicide watch. They should be very careful with him. They should keep him in isolation. He has obviously the potential to hurt guards and other prisoners, and other prisoners might hurt him. And again, the presumption of innocence is still in sure. place. I think he is a suicide, and it's always better to err on the side of being too cautious and watching them rather than being too relaxed and then having a suicide on your hands. I think he is a possible suicide risk, and I certainly think that he should be on a suicide watch.
One more question before we wrap up for today. This is something that there's been some confusion on, where some reports coming out and saying that the FBI did request Koberger be pulled over by the troopers. A new report actually being released today from the FBI saying we did not request that to be done by those troopers. When he was pulled over on his journey from Idaho back to Pennsylvania with his father, of course, being pulled over two times, almost back to back. If you were the agent in that was, you know, supposed to be tracking him, following him and tailing him back to Pennsylvania, and you see two troopers back to back pulling him over, and you're trying to keep him, you know, not suspicious, what's going through your mind as you see this happening repeatedly?
Yeah, I mean, it's like the worst luck in the world, right? When the first reports came out, I said, you know, I don't know if it is. It certainly could be. That's a technique I've used myself when I used to work the mafia in New York City. Mm-hmm. I certainly used that technique. I had NYPD uniform people do a pretext stop. We go pretend. And so, you know, it's certainly a tool that the FBI sometimes uses and other law enforcement uses. And I didn't think it was in this case, at least the second one, because we would never pull somebody over that in that short a period of time, because the last thing you want to do is you have your suspect kind of get suspicious about these stops. So, you know, because then they could take off, they could speed, they could run. And so, if at all, I didn't think both were. And I said this, I think maybe the first one could have been because the first one was a sheriff on a interstate. The sheriffs don't usually do traffic infraction on the interstate. Yeah. That's usually a trooper's job. They can, of course, they're law enforcement. If they see an infraction, they can do it, but they usually don't. And so when I heard it was a sheriff on an interstate, I said, well, that's unusual. Mm-hmm. That could have been the FBI directing. But the FBI has come out with a statement saying they didn't. And so that's truthful, because the FBI would not make a statement like that if it were true, if it were not true, because that could come back on them later at trial. You don't want to do anything for a defense counsel to say, look, the FBI was lying about this. They could be lying about something else. You know, so I think that the FBI didn't direct it. Now, could have been directed by Moscow PD or Idaho State Police who were working with it. It could have been. But the FBI did come out and say, you know, and I don't always take what the FBI says, you know, as gospel. Sure. But I think in this case, they wouldn't have risked hurting the case by making that statement if it wasn't true.
Do you think Koberger felt that they were on to him at some point? I mean, where he continued to wear gloves, people saying that they saw him in grocery stores wearing gloves not to leave fingerprints on things or DNA.
Was that back in Pennsylvania, I think?
I believe so.
I think that probably, and, you know, quite frankly, could have been a result of those two stops, especially the second stop, you know, because, you know, two stops for minor fractions on that kind of highway. I mean, everybody speeds, everybody tailgates, everybody, you know, and to be pulled over twice in 8 or 10 minutes, I think he probably got a little scared. And look, when someone commits a crime, and if they're not a career criminal, they're always looking over their shoulder. They always see the boogeyman being police. They always see police whether sometimes we're there, or sometimes we're not. And so he might have, even if they weren't orchestrated, or they were orchestrated by somebody else, not the FBI, but even if they were not orchestrated, he could have thought they were and freaked out and said, I'm going to take extra precautions. So I think maybe that second stop maybe told him, you know, they may be onto me. And so that's why he started doing, again, those are forensic countermeasures. But again, on an amateurish level, wearing gloves to a grocery store, you know, is not going to, you know, it, you know, we would just follow him to where he took the gloves off and get the DNA from the inside of the gloves. It's just another way of us to do it.
What was your take on his reaction on the traffic stop video where he immediately volunteered information that they were just leaving the area where there had been another shooting, not his specific stabbing or that crime, but there had been another, I believe it was on the campus in Washington. Wasn't even asked about it from the troopers, but suddenly that was brought up into conversation repeatedly.
I saw the father bring it up, and I thought immediately that it was an attempt to avoid having the four student murders come up.
Yeah.
Because he says WSU, and then the trooper asks, well, what is WSU? I mean, you're in Indiana. They don't know. They're not next door to Washington State. So then he says, Washington State. And the father incorrectly says there was a mass shooting. There wasn't. There was just a SWAT team killed one perpetrator kind of thing. But it was almost a forced conversation. And it seemed to me like, look, they're driving a white Elantra. The entire country is looking for a white Elantra. This was this country. The coverage of this story was not confined to Moscow, Idaho. No. Everybody, you know, a national news is talking about a white Elantra for weeks, and they're driving in a white Elantra. And the father knows the son goes to school 10 minutes from the murder site and has a white Elantra. So I think that driving across the country in a white Elantra that's coming from that area, they probably knew that the police may be looking for white Elantras now. So I think that they were nervous. It seemed like a very forced conversation and a topic to brought up. And like I said, I think they might have brought that up to avoid the topic of the four student murders.
Bobby Chacone, retired FBI special agent, thank you for joining us. That's going to wrap up today's episode of the program. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts just to not miss any episodes. If you'd like a commercial-free experience of the show, you can find that through Apple Podcasts on our channel there. My name is Tony Bruschi. You can follow me on Twitter at TonyBPod for more conversation and updates on this case off the air. Until next time, for all of us at True Crime Today and the University of Idaho Murders podcast, Four Killed for What? Thanks for listening.